was working in science class, and I thought that I'd try to make a theory for it.
Pressure pads, got an infrared, we got a horn check.
My project is on aerodynamics.
Been working on solar energy for quite a while.
Many of the people that are here today are brighter than their teachers.
I think you've lost me already, but you created this board?
Yeah, I designed it and wired it.
The path it takes is very similar to the path a satellite takes around the Earth.
When a fish passes between two transducers, it reflects the signal.
Selected from thousands of youngsters across Canada.
We have never found it in any scientific books, so we feel it is new.
You wouldn't learn this in grade 8, would you?
No, I read a lot of books.
Definitely giving off the gamma rays.
I'll demonstrate.
Science and the sparks behind it.
That flash of insight
that can help change the world.
From a tsunami detection system
to a personal drone that could save your life.
And the Canada-wide Science Fair celebrates its 60th anniversary this year.
You heard some voices of Science Fair competitors at the start there.
And we'll hear from some of those who took the top prize this year.
Earlier this weekend, actually.
The young people behind those inventions, they're smart.
Very, but often it's not just the analytical knowledge these kids have that lead to amazing inventions and experiments.
Sometimes there's a bit of an extra push.
An aha, if you will.
A spark that might require your brain to blink.
We'll get to what that means.
And how you might be able to create the right conditions to create your own
Eureka, Eureka.
We should say, I'm Dennis Kelnan.
I'm Manjula Salvaraja.
All right, Manjula, where do we start?
I met with a few people who've made it to the big show, the Canada-wide Science Fair. The first person I want to tell you about appeared at the Nationals nearly two decades ago, in 2005.
My name is Barbara Ratnam. I live in Toronto, Ontario, and I am an elementary school teacher for the Toronto Catholic District School Board.
I popped in to visit her at her home in Scarborough, Ontario. Her story about the science fair starts at an unlikely place, the aftermath of a huge news event. Dennis, I'm not sure if you remember this from 2004.
Tonight, disaster in Asia.
The tsunamis arrived as enormous surges of water.
The tidal waves hit Bangladesh, Malaysia, India, and Thailand. The
world. Yeah, I remember. That was so sudden and devastating.
For minutes, all of a sudden we're awake and water is just pouring through everywhere. Within a minute, the room had 2 feet of water in it, and we were standing on our bed, and it was starting to float.
Yes, and what we had here in Canada were generations of families from these countries watching the aftermath from here.
I remember that day very well. It was Boxing Day, and when the news came out, I remember vividly the facial expressions that my parents had on their face. They were in tears, and they weren't talking. Everyone in the room was very silent, and nobody was moving. We were all just glued to the news. I remember at that age trying to process everything that was happening, and the news started to play videos of houses being destroyed and people being swept away. And very quickly, I realized the magnitude of the destruction that that tsunami had caused. And it was devastating.
The earthquake was the strongest on the planet in 40 years. It was, however, the tsunamis that caused the destruction. People simply had no chance. There is no warning system in southern Asia. So even hours after the earthquake hit, as the tsunamis rolled toward the shorelines, frantic efforts to warn people had failed.
So let's look at a timeline of what happened that Boxing Day morning.
Okay.
The earthquake off the coast of Sumatra was at 7:58 a.m. A warning system in the Pacific in Hawaii noted it 15 minutes later. So 15 minutes later, there was some kind of a warning.
Hmm.
Now, the waves hit Thailand an hour and a half later and Sri Lanka 2 hours later. So there was time to warn people, Dennis, maybe even save lives, if there had been warning systems in place.
And that sparked a lot of questions for me.
Why were there no such systems in place? Were they just too expensive for these countries?
Round that time, coincidentally, a few of the toilets in our house were broken. And so my dad had asked me to come and help him fix it. And while I was holding on to a few things, Dad was explaining how toilets work. And that was my aha moment. In that moment, I realized, with everything that I had been learning about tsunamis and, you know, the timeline of December 26, that I could use a similar mechanism that's found in toilets to be able to detect when water is receding.
So she watched a toilet flush and...
Yeah, that was it. And from that, she decided to design an affordable tsunami detection system. She built a few prototypes and tested them in Lake Ontario. She then took this to the local fair. She won. Then she went to the regional one. She won there, too. And then she took it to the Nationals in Vancouver.
And?
You've got to wait for that answer.
At that age, being by yourself in a you know, province that you've never visited before, it was a bit nerve-wracking. But the more I got to speak and talk about my ideas, the more comfortable I became. I can show it to you if you like.
Does it still work?
Yeah, it does. It does. Ideally, we would fill up water in the tank, and the level of water in the tube would match the water outside. So if the water is receding, the level of water in the tube will also go down, and eventually...
Okay, wait. I don't know what she's talking about.
Okay, I'm going to describe it to you. So imagine a clear box made of plexiglass full of water with a tall, clear cylinder right in the middle. The cylinder has a little ball in it that floats. It's right at the top. And at the bottom of the cylinder are these two infrared lights. Now let's talk about what happens with a tsunami.
When a tsunami is generated, it can travel in two different ways. One with the crest, which is the top of a wave, and the other with the bottom, which is the trough. And when a tsunami is traveling with a trough, when it approaches near the coastal shore, the water recedes.
So if the water is receding, the level of water in the tube will also go down. So the ball then goes down with the level of the water. It obstructs the infrared lights and triggers the alarm.
Receding, and as the water recedes, the ball...
Did you actually subject people to that alarm all through?
I honestly didn't realize until we came here and we were just testing it before you came. And I said, oh my goodness, the amount of people that must have got so annoyed with me.
Okay, stop.
So loud. I'm so sorry.
I mean, I can only imagine what people in the room were thinking, having to hear this every couple of minutes every time she demonstrated this. But hey, she did win big, actually, a gold medal in the engineering category.
I was overwhelmed with so many emotions that I couldn't even utter the words that I won the gold. Like, it was, that was the honest truth. I was on the bus. Someone had to pick the phone up for me and be like, she won, because I couldn't find the words to say it. But it was a moment that I won't forget.
You're Manjula Selvaraja.
You're Dennis Kelnan.
Science and the moment ideas connect to make a spark.
Eureka, eureka.
So Barbara was watching the news, processing what's going on in the world. But when she had her aha moment, she wasn't plugged in. She was actually doing something completely different.
Right. Eureka moments. I wanted to find out how they come about, so I called John Kunios. He's a professor of psychology in the Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences at Drexel University in Philadelphia.
These aha moments really are a unique mental process.
He's also co-author of the book, The Eureka Factor, Aha Moments, Creative Insight, and the Brain.
The brain processes involved in generating these aha moments is very different from the brain processes involved in working through a problem in a deliberate analytical fashion. You can arrive at a solution or an idea in multiple ways with multiple different types of mental processes. So yes, you can arrive at a solution with a eureka moment, or you can arrive at a solution by working through a problem in a deliberate, conscious way. So yes, there are multiple paths to get to the idea or the solution.
Okay, so do I get to have a choice in this? Do I get to choose when I want to go the deliberate path to find a solution, or do I wait for an insight to just appear?
Yeah, there are some problems for which you just have to take the analytical route. As an example, if you have to add up a column of numbers, you can't just sit back and wait for an aha moment to throw the total at you. You have to use those addition skills you learned in elementary school. But in some cases, you could use an aha.
It's too big. It's too complicated. It may be vague. So, for example, the novelist Somerset Maugham once said, there are three rules for writing a novel. Unfortunately, no one knows what they are. You can't come up with a recipe or a formula for writing a novel, at least not a good one. You'll need these flashes of insight, and then you could use methodical thinking to sort of tie things together, to check things, to edit what you're doing.
Did he give a sense of which approach gives you the better result?
I was curious about that, too. I put that question to him.
When a person comes up with a solution through an aha moment, it's more likely to be correct than when they come up with the solution in a deliberate, analytical fashion. This really surprised us, because when you have an aha moment, often it seems like it comes from the great beyond. And you wonder, you know, could this be right or is it wrong? Well, at least in laboratory settings, it's more likely to be correct.
Huh, that's a surprise.
Right? I mean, he says the reason is that before a eureka moment, your mind is doing these unconscious mental computations. It's not rushed. It's taking its own time. And when those mental processes are complete, the idea pops into your awareness as an aha moment.
So take, for example, adding up a column of numbers. You can make mistakes if you're tired, or if you come up with a solution and you don't check your results, or you're distracted. You can have errors, and that can lead to incorrect ideas. So often insights turn out to be better because your unconscious mind does not care if you're tired. It doesn't care if you have a deadline. It doesn't care when you want this to happen. It runs through to completion and then gives you your insight. Whereas analytical thinking, you know, you can sort of declare victory. Oh, this is good enough. Here's the answer. You could be tired or whatever. And it's more error prone.
Now, before you go off trying to have as many eureka moments as possible, I need to tell you about false insights.
Huh, what are those?
Aha moments that are just wrong.
No, they may have a wrong idea about, for example, whether to invade another country, or what the best policy is for a government, or what the best economic policy is, or perhaps they might have an aha moment about what profession they might go into, or who their spouse should be. There is no clear way to determine whether an idea is right or wrong. But sometimes people get aha moments because an idea seems to fit. So we have to be careful of these potential false insights.
How can we tell the difference?
It's hard to tell. And what makes it harder is that both true and false insights, they both give you a high. As an example, we've debated about things, and we've both taken completely different points of view, and both felt...
Right. So, oh, that's you having a false insight.
No, you having a false insight.
Because... Well,
it can be very dramatic. It can feel very compelling. It can be accompanied by a burst of emotion. In fact, one of our recent studies shows that many people, they have a burst of activity in the brain's reward system. It's the same reward system that responds to delicious foods, addictive drugs, even orgasm. So aha moments can be very powerful for people who have these strong emotions associated with them, and they can feel right, perhaps when they're not.
John walked me through what happens in the brain when you have these insights.
At the moment that the person has the aha experience, there's a burst of high-frequency activity in the brain, brain waves, in the right temporal lobe, so just above the right ear. And that's an area that is involved in making connections between distant concepts. It's involved in, for example, understanding the gist of an idea. It's involved in understanding jokes and metaphors. It's an important area for making connections and associations, particularly remote associations, things that don't initially seem to go together, but really have some subtle connection between them.
He then explained what happens leading up to that aha moment.
And that once we found that marker in the brain of aha, we decided to look backwards in time. What were the brain processes that led up to that burst of activity in the right temporal lobe? And we found a whole sequence of activities that go on outside of awareness that lead to an aha moment. One of the ones that really struck us, because we just didn't expect anything like that, was that just a fraction of a second before that burst of activity that corresponds to the eureka moment, we found a burst of low-frequency brain activity in the brain's visual cortex, the part of the brain that processes information coming from the eyes. And what this burst of activity reflected was, we call it a brain blink.
I like it. A brain blink.
Yeah, it's this brief amount of time where you become less aware of the environment.
Your visual cortex sort of reduces activity for just a second. So you might think of it in the following terms. If you were to look someone right in the face and ask them a difficult question, what they'll probably do is look away, or they might look down at their feet or up. They might even close their eyes in order to think, to come up with a solution, because visual information is distracting. So you close your eyes or you look away. That allows the brain to focus inward and allows an unconscious idea to sort of bubble up into awareness. And in fact, other studies have found that you can enhance or make more likely aha moments or other creative ideas, sometimes just by closing your eyes.
All right, so obviously, the best thing to do is to just close my eyes.
No. You can't just sit around and just close your eyes and wait for an insight. You still need to feed your brain and experience things that make your brain eventually have a eureka moment.
As the great biomedical researcher Louis Pasteur said, chance favors only the prepared mind. If your mind is prepared for an insight, then you'd be more likely to have one.
The word eureka, there's a bit of a story behind it.
Yes. So it's ancient Greek and translates to I found it. One of the greatest scientists who ever lived, Archimedes, is said to have uttered it when he discovered something. So here's the story. The tale goes that the king of Syracuse in Sicily, where Archimedes lived, gave a goldsmith a bar of gold to have a crown made. But once he got that crown back, he had these suspicions that the goldsmith may have pulled a fast one on him and mixed in a bit of other cheaper materials. So Archimedes was tasked with figuring out if the crown was all gold. One day, while he was taking a bath, he noticed that when he got into the tub, water had spilled over the edge. And that's when he had this eureka moment. A crown of gold and a gold bar should spill the same amount of water. Meanwhile, a crown mixed with gold and silver wouldn't. That's how he would be able to tell and give an answer to the king. It's said that when he got out of the tub, he ran around on the streets naked, yelling, "Eureka!"
Fun imagery. What happened to the crown?
Well, Archimedes figured out that the goldsmith had indeed cheated the king. It's an interesting story. I mean, you'll come across statues of him in museums, Archimedes sitting in a bathtub. There's actually one in Israel's National Museum of Science, Technology and Space. And now, of course, the word Eureka is associated with this idea of the sudden joy of discovery.
Sudden joys of discovery. So besides the one of the man running around naked yelling Eureka, what are some of your favorite Eureka moments from history?
Yesterday. Paul McCartney waking out of bed one morning in the cramped attic room where he was staying, noting that he had this tune in his head, turning to the piano by his bed and playing it out. He says he didn't know where the tune came from and kept calling it Scrambled Eggs.
Wow, one of the Beatles' most famous and covered songs, thankfully not called Scrambled Eggs. Oh, yesterday
came suddenly. I have one more discovery. This is about a useful appliance that most of us own. So, in 1946, an engineer called Percy Spencer reached into his pocket to get a snack. He had saved a peanut cluster bar in his pocket. When he reached in, of course, in his words, it was a gooey, sticky mess. Now, Spencer was working around radar technology, and he put two and two together. He realized the equipment was gently heating his food. Now, here's the aha moment. He decided to try other food in his equipment. He put an egg in it, and it actually burst in his face. But that little failure aside, that was the start of the microwave.
Wow. So you have to realize you've just had this insight, and then you have to do something with it.
Yes, yeah.
I like the one John Cunios told us.
In the early 1950s, nobody knew what the shape of our galaxy, the Milky Way, is. And it may seem kind of obvious, you know, that what it should look like, but there are actually many different types of galaxies, and they have different shapes, different forms. So in the early 1950s, there was a famous astronomer, William Wilson Morgan. And this was a question that really interested him, but that wasn't what he was working on at the time. He was working on a phenomenon called OB associations. These are young, hot, bright stars that occur in sort of clusters, sort of star nurseries in galaxies. And he knew that these OB associations tended to occur in the spiral arms of spiral galaxies. In other shaped galaxies, they occur in other parts of it. So he was working at the Yerkes Observatory, and he was computing the distances of a lot of these hot, young, bright stars. And he finished for the evening, and he started walking home at night. And while he was walking home, he looked up at the sky, and he saw a lot of the OB Association stars that whose distances he had been computing, and he knew from memory what the distances of a lot of those stars were. And as he looked up at the night sky, it connected. And he suddenly saw it in three dimensions. It was a great aha moment. And he could see that these stars existed in depth, in a strand. And he realized at that moment that that was the strand of a spiral arm of a spiral galaxy. He knew in that instant, our Milky Way galaxy is a spiral galaxy. It leapt out, it was like a painting that came to life. And I think that's one of the great aha moments in scientific history.
So how can you prime yourself for more aha moments?
We'll come back after the break with more
Eureka, Eureka.
I'm not going to give you a lecture on what I hold to be important in life. Just let me say this time, and I hope never again, I'm not interested in marriage or settling down. Science is my life and nothing else. Science is my life and nothing else. And nothing else. Science is my life and nothing else. Science is my life and nothing else. And nothing else.
Ready? From the first sliver of an idea
to an onslaught of brilliance,
science,
and the sparks behind it.
From the first Canadian woman in space
to kids in lab coats at the Canada-wide science fair.
We'll go to the root of where ideas come from.
The moments connections are made and push intelligence
with a touch of aha.
And how to encourage your brain to blink
and deliver on a bit of insight.
You won't need your Bunsen burners
nor flint strikers.
This is
Eureka, Eureka. I'm Manjula Selvaraja.
And I'm Dennis Kelnan. Let's start the half hour with an overachiever.
10, 9, 8, 7. We have a go for main engine start. We have 3 main engines up and running. 3, 2, 1. Zero.
Hi, I'm Dr. Roberta Bonder.
Her achievements are very numerous. She has degrees in biology and medicine. She is an environmental educator. She studies how the brain adapts to unfamiliar environments, as well as neurological illnesses like Parkinson's. She has, get this, 28 honorary doctorates from universities from across North America.
You're bearing the lead here. She was the first Canadian woman in space and the world's first neurologist in space.
And liftoff of the Space Shuttle Discovery and the first International Microgravity Laboratory.
She had been listening to a tape of O Canada just hours earlier as she gazed down on wintertime in the Northwest Territories.
If you could recognize all the land features, it's just fantastic.
Bonder is researching the effect the absence of gravity has on the human spine. The spine elongates by as much as 7 centimeters in space.
Bonder says some of her very first steps to a life jam-packed with achievement, attending science fairs.
I'm happy to celebrate the 60th anniversary of the Canada-wide Science Fair. In grade 12, I received an honorable mention in the Canada-wide Science Fair for my project on the forest tent caterpillar. It marked the beginning of my path to becoming a scientist, medical doctor, and astronaut.
And get this, in an homage to the fair, Bonder took a bit of it to the stars.
As a tribute to that event, I selected my Canada-wide Science Fair pin to fly in space with me. The pin is a globe into which a key is inserted, a very appropriate and much cherished reminder of how science can unlock the world.
And her achievements inspire the next generation of scientists and artists, too.
I will be granted the privilege and honor of touching the earth with my eyes, my mind, my heart, and my soul. All of you will be blended into the earthscape of blues, browns, and greens. Green, blues, green, browns, green, and greens. Green, blues, green, browns, and greens.
This is Bondarsphere. It's by Montreal composer Nicole Lisée. Moments at the science fair don't just have to be about science. I found some non-scientific moments. If I could rename them, I would call them whoa moments. start with Theresa DeCola. She was actually a serial attendee at the Canada-wide Science Fair.
I went to four, because I went to Toronto, which was in 2011. I went to Charlottetown, which was 2012. I went to Lethbridge, which was 2013. And I went to Windsor, which was 2014. So.
And four.
Theresa grew up in Belleville, Ontario. She was the only kid in her school then to make it to the fair. And she says it changed her life.
And for me, like, my aha moment of going to science fair was learning about all of these different careers, like being able to work in a research lab or being able to work for a tech company. Like, I didn't know that, like, computer programming was a job or that you could work in design at a tech company or things like that. So for me, like, a really big discovery through science fair was just, like, all the possibilities that were out there.
Theresa told me it was wonderful to be surrounded by people at the fair who were interested in the same things that she was.
Like, growing up, neither of my parents went to university, and the only people I really knew who had went to university were, like, my teachers at school or my doctor. Like, none of my family friends had. So it was really cool to be able to see, like, the judges were, like, engineers and doctors and people working on their PhD and things like that, and getting to hear about all of these different career paths that I didn't even know existed until I went.
So it opened her eyes to all these other paths. Did she follow any of them?
Yes, she did. She went on to study management engineering at the University of Waterloo. She now works as a product manager at a large tech multinational and is jetting off to California very soon. Then there's Chris Nielsen.
I'm currently a PhD student at the University of Calgary, where my research focuses on interpretable machine learning for ophthalmology. And I'm doing my PhD in biomedical engineering. The real reward from competing at these fairs, it's the empowerment of young people to pursue big ideas. And definitely having prizes and having a competition helps incentivize that. But looking back, it's the friendships. It was really, really quite beautiful. I don't know how much time we have in this interview, but
as long as you want.
Okay. A couple of years later, when I competed at the international fair, I was able to meet the wonderful woman who would become my wife.
So he met his wife at a science fair?
Yes, he met his wife, Adelina, at the international science fair. But there's more to the story. After they met, they discovered that they had both attended the same Canada-wide science fair when they were younger. It had been in 2008, and it was held in Ottawa. He and Adelina decided to look back at photos of that show.
The awards ceremony, when I went up to receive my gold medal, there was a photo taken. And it was the most beautiful thing because we had no idea. We didn't know each other at the time. But standing right next beside me was the person who would become my future wife.
That's a great story. So they actually crossed paths before they actually met each other, and all at science fairs.
Yeah.
And she had also won a gold medal at that fair. And so, science fairs have affected my life in many ways, science being one of them. But the greatest thing that's come out of the science fairs for me is actually meeting my wife, and something that I will be forever thankful for.
Science is real. Just a hunch or guess, it's more like a question. It's been put through a lot.
Science is Real by They Might Be Giants.
You're Manjula Selvaraja.
You're Dennis Kelnan.
Science and the moment ideas connect to make a spark.
Eureka, eureka.
Okay, Manjula, I feel like we've all been at moments where we just can't get the sparks flying. Is there a way to prime yourself to have more eureka moments?
Yes, we can. John Kunios, who we heard earlier, looks at this in his book, The Eureka Factor, Aha Moments, Creative Insight, and the Brain. He says, though, that we can't simply command our brains to have more aha moments.
You can't force it. Aha moments are like cats. They don't take orders.
But cats and I don't get along. I'm not going to have eureka moments.
You can create the right conditions, the right mindset, the right mental state to have an aha moment.
We need to coax them out. And that starts with you feeling psychologically safe.
So think of it this way. Imagine that you are an early human on the savannah in Africa. And you see way off in the distance a lion. And immediately you'll become very focused and very analytical and very deliberate. You'll think, now, does that lion detect me? Does that lion see me? Am I upwind or downwind? Have I been making noise? You know, if the lion detects you, you're dead. There's nothing you can do. The lion can outrun you. The lion can get you. So you start thinking in a very analytical fashion because you can't afford to make a mistake. You have to monitor what you're doing, what you're thinking very carefully. However, let's say you escape the lion and you go back to your clan. You're in your cave at night. You have a nice warm fire. You have plenty of food. You're around your family. In a situation like that, you feel safe. There's no threat. You can take risks. The risk could be how you think. You can think creatively. You can think thoughts that may be wild. They may be crazy. They may be flat out wrong. But there's nothing to lose by thinking in that sort of loose, associative, wild kind of way, creatively. So psychological safety, that's the term that psychological scientists use. Psychological safety breeds creativity. It sets the stage for aha moments.
That there is a large body of research that shows that people have more insights when they're in a positive mood. Because at such times, you are obviously relaxed and don't feel a sense of threat.
So this goes back to what we heard earlier in the program. So the guy who had a flash of insight about gold while taking a bath.
You mean Archimedes, one of the greatest mathematicians who ever lived?
Yeah. Him and then the guy who looked at the stars and saw the structure of the galaxy while walking around.
Are you doing this on purpose? That's William Wilson Morgan. Brilliant astronomer. Go on.
These brilliant people are having these eureka moments when they're not sitting in front of their books or staring at computers.
Yeah, and when they're not immersed in what they're supposed to be solving. I'm sure you've heard of people say that they get their best ideas in don't know, in the shower?
I get my best ideas on a walk.
There you go. John says there are two factors at play there, and they're connected. Your attention and the environment you're in.
If you're in a space, a large space, like say you're outside, or if you're indoors in a large room with high ceilings, your attention spreads to fill that space. Similarly, your mind expands to allow in ideas that may seem irrelevant or trivial. We also know that that's tied to attention. So when you're looking at that line off in the distance, your visual attention is narrowly focused on the line. You can't take your attention off that. You're not distracted by other things. Conversely, if your attention is spread out, you'll find that spread of attention also allows remote ideas, remote associations, irrelevant seeming thoughts to come into awareness.
So the vastness of the outdoors allow these remote and random thoughts to appear and intermingle in your brain, allowing you to make some interesting, perhaps even unconventional connections. He also points out that the color in our environments can also influence us.
The color red signifies danger, emergency, stop. It signifies blood. That, again, grabs attention and narrows it, whereas colors like blue and green, outdoor earthy colors, can convey a sense of safety and relaxation, which then expand the mind. Many famous creative figures have talked about liking to take walks out in nature, whether it's in valleys, in the forest, in the mountains, in order to get ideas. And it may very well be for that same reason.
The 60th Canada-wide Science Fair was mostly online this year.
Many winners, 7 top ones, but really endless ingenuity.
Combating eutrophication by removing phosphate from water.
With this data, we built an AI to classify the type of cancer present within these genes.
I chose to look at a way to treat and prevent harmful algae blooms that was cost-effective, that used a native and natural solution. Project goal is to find unknown asteroids using middle math school skills, open data, and programming.
Can those bacteria and fungi specifically be transferred to humans and harmfully impact them through such a normalized experience as looking?
That I would have to modify my biochars with muscle shell to try and get that additional phosphate gene to a minimum.
Early cancer screening to detect genetic signs of cancer.
Then delivering emergency medication to patients under surveillance with a pillbox.
And the scientific community is so welcoming and supportive.
I called up one of the platinum winners, Max Du, a grade 9 student from Queen Elizabeth High School in Calgary.
Hello.
How does it feel to be a winner?
It feels great, actually. When they first announced it, I was, like, really excited because it's my first time participating in, like, the Calgary-wide Science Fair, and I didn't expect any awards or prizes, so I felt ecstatic.
Tell me about your project. What did you focus on?
Well, the challenge that I was trying to solve was to help rescue more cardiac arrest patients at home. It means that their heart stops beating suddenly and they die within like 10 minutes and only 10% survive. And it's even worse if they're home alone unwitnessed because only 4% survive then. So my Science Fair project was a solution to make a drone more intelligent so it can 1, start rescue faster before EMS arrives, and 2, help save those patients home alone as well. I designed 4 features to locate and approach patients in seconds, upstairs or downstairs, then deliver emergency medication to patients under surveillance with a pillbox and an intramuscular auto-injection, and to enable surveillance connection with an EMS team and open room doors to approach patients with an extendable arm if necessary.
If you had someone who owned one of these and they were having a cardiac arrest at home, what would happen?
The patient has sort of a lifeline around their neck where they press a button and it would send a signal to the drone as well as emergency services. Then the drone would activate and enable surveillance to the EMS team. And the drone would start moving towards the patient using its built-in technology. Once it finds the patient and it locates it, it lands and the EMS team can assess the situation, and then based on that situation, the EMS team can decide if it is necessary to inject emergency life-saving medication.
How much time typically does it take for an EMS person to appear on the scene? And how much time do you think it would take for your drone to appear on the scene?
The average response time in Canada and the U.S. is around 9 minutes for an EMS team in urban areas, and for rural areas, it's 22 minutes. My drone, based off of testing of placing it in locations of my house and flying it upstairs, it was around 55 seconds, and it landed 3 to 6 centimeters away from the patient.
What inspired you to work on something of that kind, something that helps people experiencing a cardiac arrest?
I'm really passionate about drones. I think that drones are a device with unlimited possibilities of advancement and development in the future. So when I got a drone for Christmas that year, I couldn't go outside to fly it because of the cold weather and COVID-19. So I had to fly inside of the house. And that's where I really got the inspiration to make a drone kind of like a flying robot and like an indoor helper. And after that, I did some research about heart failure and cardiac arrest. And the 30-year like low survival rate and limited solutions really motivated me to start innovating.
Did you have a eureka or an aha moment?
Yeah, I actually had one. Well, I had many, but one of them was pretty significant to my project. This one was like kind of an ingenious idea. So through my preliminary designs, I designed 4 arms and 3 grippers. But all the arm system designs were found to be too heavy to fly or ineffective in arm raising. And to me, that was very frustrating. And the worst was that I was out of ideas. So I was stuck for days just trying to figure out this one problem until one day I had like an ingenious idea that just suddenly popped up in my head. And it was clear that the drone can fly up to the doorknob and kind of cap the gripper on top of the doorknob, then land. This way, it solves both the arm raising and gripper support issue. This moment was like a huge aha moment because it just represents that like perseverance in science fair. It is very exciting.
What's next for you and for this project?
I plan to file a patent for the device just based off the validation of the current prototype. I also plan to reaching out to Health Canada and other provincial health services to get approval for this, so that we can start testing it in the real world.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Yeah, thank you for having me and for letting me share my experience.
That's it for us today.
I'm Dennis Kelman.
I'm Manjula Selvaraja.
We hope you enjoyed this bit of audio adventure.
Science.
And the sparks behind it.
Eureka, Eureka.
Pressure pads, got an infrared, we got a horn check.
I was working in science class and I thought that I'd try to make a theory for it.
My project is on aerodynamics.
I've been working on solar energy for quite a while.
Many of the people that are here today are brighter than their teachers.
I think you've lost me already, but you created this board?
Yeah, I designed it and wired it.
The path it takes is very similar to the path a satellite takes around the Earth.
When a fish passes between two transducers, it reflects the signal.
Selected from thousands of youngsters across Canada.
We have never found it in any scientific books, so we feel it is new.
You wouldn't learn this in grade 8, would you?
No, I read a lot of books.
Definitely giving off the gamma rays.
I'll demonstrate.